This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. With the election just a couple of hours away now, national polls agree that Barack Obama leads John McCain, but they don't agree by how much. A Fox News poll shows the Democrat up 3 points. A New York Times CBS survey says 11. And even on the radio, I can see a lot of you rolling your eyes. Remember New Hampshire, you say, when all the polls showed Senator Obama leading big over Senator Hillary Clinton until he lost. Pollsters don't survey people who only use cell phones, you say, and a lot of people won't talk to them at all. What about the Bradley effect, and how can the McCain camp argue that it's much closer in places like Pennsylvania on the basis of their internal numbers? Today, we want to hear from those of you who have been polled. Did you tell the truth? Did you turn them down? Tell us your story. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, your chance to campaign for the best movie president. Murray Horwitz joins us, and you can cast an early ballot now by email. Go to talk@npr.org. But first, can we trust the polls? Scott Keeter is Director of Survey Research at the Pew Research Center for People and the Press, with us here today in Studio 3A today. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you, Neil. Nice to be with you.
And all of those polls show Barack Obama in the lead. So this thing over?
It sure looks like it's over, but as you said in your opening remarks, let's not forget New Hampshire. And that was a very useful corrective to hubris for pollsters. All of the polls there said Barack Obama was going to win the New Hampshire primary, and of course he didn't. So we have to be careful about saying what we see now is what's going to happen, but this is a very consistent picture of a lead for Obama. There's a lot inside the polls that suggests that he's going to do very well. He has more enthusiasm among his backers than McCain does. And I think the question maybe is just how big the margin is going to be. But as I say, pollsters are a superstitious bunch, and we never say never.
Is this a science or is this an art?
There's a bit of both. The best pollsters, I think, come at it scientifically, and when judgments have to be applied, are able to draw on the experience of many years of practicing the craft. There are judgments that you have to make about how tight to make a likely voter screen or what the assumption is going to be about how many people are going to vote. And there, some judgment has to come into it. But this is largely a science.
And so you feel pretty confident at this point.
If we were seeing polls on both sides of the zero point, if there were polls showing McCain leading right now nationally, if there weren't such a consistent pattern of Obama leads in the states where lots and lots of polling is going on, then I would say we need to be more cautious. But right now, the candidates themselves obviously believe this because you don't see Barack Obama in Democratic states trying to defend them, and you see McCain in places that he didn't think he was ever going to have to go to, barnstorming through them today.
Yet you also see McCain working very heavily in the state of Pennsylvania, where, according to all the independent opinion polls, the ones you see in the newspapers, Barack Obama's up 8, 11 in around there somewhere, and the McCain people said, no, our internal numbers show that it's closer. Are they fibbing, or is this possible?
No, there are some public polls that are showing it a little closer, and I think that that the McCain campaign may believe that if there is a chance, if they think that the polling is not fully picking up on some skepticism about Obama, his experience, and so forth, that it would be in a place like Pennsylvania that he struggled in the primaries against Hillary Clinton. And so they're thinking that if they have a chance to steal a Democratic state away from Obama, that would be the place they could do it, and that would be a big prize. So I think that's the logic. He needs not just to hold everything that Bush held in 2004. I mean, if he did that, he would win.
He'd be president, yes.
But, you know, he has enough. There are enough states where he is trailing by significant margins that Bush won that he thinks he needs to steal a Democratic state, and Pennsylvania is the place he thinks he has the best chance to do that.
We want to hear from those of you today who have participated in opinion polls. Give us a call. Tell us what it was like. How did you respond to it? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Let's begin with Darren. And Darren calling us from American Falls in Idaho.
Yes, about 2 weeks ago I had a poll. It was very good. It took about 20 minutes, I was honest. But I was surprised, being from Idaho, must have been a national poll. I'm a political scientist, and so I was very interested in it, and it was a very well-conducted poll.
You're a political scientist, so you felt no compunction about answering the questions.
Well, yeah, and so I was listening for push questions, and I actually asked who had paid for the poll, and they said it was one of the two parties, but they wouldn't reveal which one. And it was a very, very thorough poll. It took about 20 minutes.
And what were some of the more interesting questions?
Some that I thought were more interesting is they asked about previous voting, like in other presidential elections, how many elections I had voted in, and favorable or unfavorable questions with candidates, like, you know, like on a scale of 1 to 5, if I say the candidate George W. Bush or John Kerry or Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was a very good poll.
Let me ask you, Scott, if the question about have you voted in the past, they're trying to determine whether he is a likely voter. Isn't that the category?
That's right. That's a standard question in the so-called likely voter scales that most pollsters construct, because we know that not everybody who says they're going to vote really is. And so over the years, pollsters have developed a methodology for trying to identify them. And one of the questions is, have you voted in the past? How often do you vote? Do you know where to vote in your neighborhood? And one of the controversies right now in the polling business, and one of the questions about the polls this year, has to do with whether past behavior is a good
predictor of the future,
because it may be that this is an election that has energized a lot of heretofore never voted people.
And is Darren right that they would also not tell him which of the parties had paid for the poll?
Yes, normally they certainly wouldn't tell you that anywhere up front. Normally, you know, people might tell you at the end. At a minimum, they might tell you who's doing the poll. That is, what's the field house or organization that's doing the survey. And usually if you call them back, you can find out. But most people don't go to that much trouble.
And one more question. We'll get back to you, Darren, in just a second. Stay with us. But one more question. When he talked about push polling, that's when they might ask somebody who answers the phone like Darren, how would you respond if you learned that John McCain was, in fact, a card-carrying member of the Communist Party?
Right. And there is a legitimate polling technique that is under the rubric of message testing that involves offering people information about the candidates and saying, how would you feel if you knew that, fill in the blank. That's done very routinely by campaigns, not so much by public pollsters, but by campaigns to test the effectiveness of different appeals. As long as what they're saying is not outright falsehoods or very misleading, then that's a legitimate technique to use to test your messages. Push polling is a different thing. It's not a poll at all. It's campaigning under the guise of a poll, using an invitation to participate in a poll to get people to cooperate, and then slamming the respondent with lots of negative information about the candidate that you know, is not the one paying for the poll.
And Darren, it didn't seem that way to you. It seemed pretty straight.
Oh, no, it was very straight. And in fact, I was very impressed by the amount of demographic information, income, education, race, religion, and I was sure to prize the poller when I said that I was considered myself very liberal and from Idaho and a Mormon. So I think I'm the only one who ever responded that way to one of the polls.
But. And that makes him the outlier, right? Okay. Darren, thanks. You're going to vote tomorrow?
I actually voted early last week.
Congratulations. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for taking part in that poll, too, Darren.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Emma, and Emma's with us from Fort Lauderdale in Florida.
Hi,
Emma.
I've been called so many times. I've lost count of how many times I've been robocalled, and was called yesterday again by someone who wanted to know if I was voting and who I voted for, and then actually had someone come to my door and knock on my door yesterday. From the Obama campaign to see if I was going to vote or had voted already, and I found it annoying.
I can understand.
Yeah, it's been like they're like hounding me, I feel like. So I kind of don't appreciate it. I guess I've been hesitant to participate.
Now, Emma, hold with us just a second, and let me get back to Scott Keeter. Those don't sound like polling calls. The robocalls, those are automated calls to say, hi, I'm, so-and-so, and I'm urging you to vote for or against this person.
Right. That's definitely what it sounds like. Now, they may be saying I'm conducting a poll as a way to get you to cooperate, if so, that's really not a good practice. You may be targeted because of your age or your cell phone only status or something like that as a potential Obama voter, and it may be that that's why you're getting these calls. If you are cell phone only, and maybe I should ask him, do you only have a cell phone?
I do only have a cell phone, and as I said, I live in Florida, which I know is a very hotly contested state, and I'm also registered independent.
Well, you would be one of those voters that the campaigns would be after. But the chances that you would be called by a survey organization, given that you're cell phone only, are pretty low. It really is only in this election and maybe a little bit in 2006 that pollsters were including cell phones in their samples. And so it still is an uncommon practice and almost unheard of at the statewide level.
Hmm. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And the knock on the door was somehow they had targeted you as a potential Barack Obama voter, and we were trying to urge you to go to the polls. But Emma, there's early voting in Florida. In fact, I was down there over the weekend and saw incredibly long lines.
Yes, I voted. I forget what day I voted, but I voted this week, and it took me 3 hours.
Wow.
Well, I dropped my thing.
Pardon me?
I brought my knitting with me.
You brought your knitting with you. Well,
yes.
Congratulations, and thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We're talking with Scott Keeter from the Pew Research Center for People in the Press about whether or not we can trust the opinion polls, about the methodology that goes into these polls and what is and what isn't legitimate. We're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Have you ever been polled? Tell us what it was like, what your experience was like. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A little bit later this hour, our movie pal Murray Horowitz joins us. We'll talk politics, sort of. Who's your favorite movie president? You can vote now by email, talk@npr.org. Right now, we're parsing the opinion polls. Why should we believe them? What do the numbers really tell us? Scott Keeter's our guest. He's director of survey research at the Pew Research Center for People and the Press. We want to hear from those of you who have been called. Did you tell the truth? Did you turn them down? Tell us your story. 800-989-8255. Email again, talk@npr.org. And we were talking earlier with Emma in Florida, cell phone only. And one of the real questions that people have about this year is whether opinion pollsters are getting an actual sample. Are the people who are not called, those who only have cell phones, are they going to be the same as the people who have landlines?
It's amazing, you know, we got this question a lot even 4 years ago when the number of cell-only voters was much smaller. The exit polls indicated that 7% of voters 4 years ago were cell-only. We think that number is going to be double that this year, 14, maybe 15% of voters. Most major national pollsters are now including cell phones in their samples, and our work since the middle of the summer has included cell phones in every sample, and we are seeing that it's making a difference. That is, when we blend in the cell phone respondents, we are finding the number for Obama being at least a point or two higher, the number for McCain being possibly a point or two lower. So it's making a significant difference on the margin when you look at all of the polls collectively.
And how are you doing that? Calling people on cell phones, or are you asking people, do you have only a cell phone, and then quizzing them?
Exactly. We're calling people on their cell phones. We're offering them a reimbursement for the minutes that we might be using up on their plans. And then we conduct the interview like normal. And we're getting the same response rate on cell phones that we do on landlines.
Let's get Luke on the line. Luke is calling us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi there, Neil. I was contacted by the Gallup Daily Tracking Poll the night before last. And I was, about 10 minutes into the poll, I realized that I was running out of time, and I tried to hurry the pollster along. But I ended up having to get off the phone because I just didn't have enough time to complete the poll. And I was wondering if anybody has studied this problem as a form of bias. And I'll take my comments off the air.
It sounds like you've got a young voter there you need to take care of.
Yeah.
All right. Bye-bye.
Well, yes, we have studied that. I think that it's almost certainly the case that his responses to the questions that he was asked would not have been included in their poll. They would only include him if they could make it to the demographic section where they could properly weight him into the sample. We find that the people who break off during the interview tend to be less interested in politics, less engaged. They tend to be a little less educated. And that does create a potential for a small bias, but the number that we lose that way is very small. Typically, fewer than 1 in 10 interviews that we start end up having to be terminated. And, you know, he sounded like somebody who would have been happy to finish if he just hadn't had something else going on.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of pollsters, including Gallup, will probably try to recontact him. It may be that given the lateness of the call that he got that he wouldn't get recontacted, but, you know, we do make an effort. So by and large, this bias is very small, but there is a potential there.
He also used a term of art that a lot of people don't understand. Tracking poll. What's the difference between a regular opinion poll and a tracking poll?
Yes, the tracking polls involve what are called rolling samples. The pollster will open up, which is to say, start calling a new fresh piece of their sample, maybe a couple of thousand numbers. On a given day, they'll interview people out of it. The next day, they'll open up another sample of equivalent size, but they'll keep calling the people they had called the night before. Maybe they'll do that for 3 or 4 nights. They'll average the numbers together, and then as they go forward, they'll drop out the sample from the day that they started with and add the new day in. And so several of the polls, including ABC, Washington Post, and the Gallup poll that he mentioned, are doing that.
Let's get June on the line. June with us from Nashville in Tennessee.
Yes, hi.
Hi, June.
Hi. Well, I have to admit that I lied on a poll.
What did you say?
Well, it was automated. I would never have done this to a real person. It was during the primaries, and the first question was, are you Republican or Democrat? And I'm a Democrat, and I don't know why, oppositionality, I guess, I pressed Republican.
Uh-huh.
And then I answered honestly from that point on, and they went through the whole list of all the primary candidates, and I answered that part honestly. And then after that, well, I felt really bad. I kind of didn't know, you know, what kind of echoing effects this might have in the universe. And then I started getting calls from, I got a call from Minnesota against Al Franken, wanting me to contribute to
Norm Coleman.
Yeah, Norm Coleman. And I was honest with that guy, and I said, I think I just got on the wrong list. You don't want to call me. Take me off. And there were a couple of those, and then it kind of went away.
Uh-huh.
But it made me feel really guilty. I would never do that. I think that part of the issue is I would never do that to a real person.
Uh-huh. Well, we're glad you stepped into the radio confessional.
Yeah, I feel better already.
Good. We'll announce your penance in a few minutes, but is this an issue, Scott?
Yes. Well, I think she already paid her penance by ending up on a partisan list, but certainly the confession takes care of it. We don't think it's really a very serious problem. I mean, I think people sometimes do, and sometimes people just mistakenly answer. But if it were a really serious problem, polling would not have been as accurate as it has been in elections over the years. 4 years ago, in a very tough race between Kerry and Bush, national polling was very accurate. The average of the major national polls came within about a half a point of the actual margin. There certainly are questions that people find uncomfortable to answer, such as whether they have cheated on their taxes, how frequently they go to religious services and the like. And there may be some exaggeration to make a person look better or make them look less bad. But we don't think that in politics there's any particular stigma to saying that you're voting for one person over another. And so we generally don't worry about lying.
June, thanks very much, and go away and sin no more.
I will sin no more, and I obsessively watch the polls now, I'll tell you. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Here's an email we have from Karen in Elkhart, Indiana. I'm a black American, and I find it strange that polls come out giving the black view, but very few people of color are ever polled. This is a discussion I've had doing my own poll of people of color, that polls come out, but we can't recall ever in the last four elections receiving a call, so it's hard for me to respect the polls.
This is something that we hear from a lot of people, and not just African Americans. A lot of times we get comments from people in our website or over the phone that just say, I've never been polled. How can we believe the polls? The fact is there has been an enormous amount of polling this year. But even at that, the chances that any given American voter would have been called are very small. There are hundreds of millions of Americans, 200 and something million adults, and the collective total of all of the polling is going to fall probably well below 50 million, if anywhere near that. It's hard to estimate. So there's a very good chance that as an individual you wouldn't be polled. All of the polls that use random sampling give every person an equal chance, and so we know that when we get our sample back, we have reached roughly the proper proportion of African Americans that there are in the population. If we fall short, we correct that with statistical weighting, giving the African Americans we interview a little more of a weight in the poll. But generally speaking, we're pretty close on our demographics.
Does that increase your margin of error when you have to weight it a little bit?
It does. Weighting, depending on how severe it is, can make your margin of error larger than it would be if you had a perfectly random sample.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller on the line. And let's go to Jim. And Jim's calling us from Greenwich, Connecticut.
Oh, hi. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
I'm interested in politics and polling. I guess whenever I've been called, I just am reluctant to answer pollsters because over the phone, I honestly don't know if somebody is who they say they are, whether it's a push poll or, you know, it's a legitimate big-name poller. So I just kind of answer a few questions and then often just say, well, no thanks, I'm going to stop answering. So my question is there a significant bias based on, I don't know, where you live or educational or, you know, ethnic background to where people just drop out?
Yep.
Thanks. And I'll listen on the air.
Okay, thanks for the call, Jim. And Scott Keeter, I've heard that since the no-call list also came out, of course, pollsters are allowed to call, but nevertheless, more and more people feel empowered to say, you know what, I don't want to talk to you.
We are experiencing the same thing that all pollsters are experiencing, which is a decline in response rates. Some of it comes from people who are worried about the loss of privacy. They wonder if they're being scammed in some way. But it's also the case that people just have very busy lives and they have a lot going on, and they are less likely to talk to us simply because of that. The good thing is that we have not found in some very extensive research that non-response is creating a serious bias in our polls. That is, the kinds of people that aren't talking with us do not appear to be significantly different from the people who do. It's as if non-response is just random. People are busy one day, they won't talk to us, but the next day they're at home and they don't have as much going on and they do the interview. And that seems to be helping us to continue to get good samples.
Here's an email from Al in Milwaukee. Television networks stopped predicting results based on Election Day exit polls before all the polls closed because of fear that people hearing a candidate had already won would not vote. Shouldn't the same apply to pre-election polls? Won't a poll saying one candidate is strongly in the lead induce some people to think they don't have to vote or that it's futile to vote? Does your guest have a solution for this?
We think that polling is just one more source of information to voters to help them to assess what's going on in a campaign. There wouldn't be any particular reason to throw polls overboard rather than measures of fundraising and other indications of candidate strength. We think that polling actually is very helpful. I mean, the fact that you know that one candidate's ahead or not may not be particularly useful unless you're somebody who contributes to candidates very early in the primary season and you don't want to give your money to somebody who has no chance of winning. But most polling... Like John McCain a year ago, and quite a story of his ability to overcome that. But polling does a lot more than just tell you who's ahead. We try to explain, you know, what kinds of people are supporting each candidate, why they're supporting each candidate, what's the dynamic going on. And that it seems to me, is a service to the voters. It helps people to understand whether the claims that a candidate is making about why they're ahead in terms of support for some of their policy proposals are really borne out by what people are telling us. It seems that's very valuable information for the public to have.
We're talking with Scott Keeter of the Pew Research Center for People and the Press. He's with us here in Studio 3A. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And one more term of art before we get back to the phones, and that is exit polls. How are exit polls different from opinion polls?
Well, an exit poll is an opinion poll. It's just that it's conducted in person at a polling place. There actually are exit polls that are done not just for elections, but to judge how people reacted to a movie as they leave it, or even to intercept people as they come out of a library to find out how they felt about it. But exit polls in the political context are interviews with voters as they leave the polling place, and those are useful to us also in understanding why people voted the way they did, what kinds of people supported each of the candidates, and ultimately that helps to serve as a basis of an explanation for the election.
Let's see if we can now go to Miller. And Miller's on the line with us from, is this Mannheim in Germany?
That's right.
Go ahead, please.
Yes. Well, I was wondering with polling whether overseas voters are ever taken into account.
Americans abroad, yes.
And there is, of course, quite a large number of overseas voters.
And I think roughly about half of them actually register and vote absentee, but they vote in their states where they're originally from. Do you do that, Miller?
Yes, that's what I do.
Okay.
The answer is, as far as I know, most pollsters do not try to capture overseas voters. I don't know exactly how we would do that unless we were sampling off of registered voter lists rather than using random digit dialing, which is the methodology that most of the national pollsters use. With a registered voter list, I could get you in a sample, and then if I could figure out how to get to you, either by email or by a phone call, I might include you. But polls don't include overseas voters.
Do they include the military?
The military is eligible. I mean, we don't ask people what they do for a living or if they are active duty when we call them. So if they're stateside in one of the 48...
But if they're overseas, they're in the same category as
yes,
Miller.
Yes, yes, okay. Exactly.
By the way, Miller, you may want to join us on Thursday. We're doing a show called Talk of the World that day in this time slot. Talk of the Nation becomes Talk of the World. We're going to get calls from people all around the globe, we hope, to react to the American election and have them tell us what they think Americans need to know about them and their world now. So,
well, I'll be glad to do so.
All right. Talk to you then. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
And let's see if we get one last caller in. And let's go to, this is Russell, and Russell's with us from Leavenworth County in Kansas.
Hello.
Hi.
I've been polled twice, once by a private number, private name, which I don't know, but it felt pushish polling. And after that, I got a robocall suggesting that voting for Obama would be tantamount to slitting my throat, which I, you know, took with a grain of salt because, well, Obama's my man. With the other poll, I was a legitimate poll. I suspect they wanted a lot of information about who I was, what I did, why I felt registering to vote was a good idea, and so forth and so on, and then asked about my candidate choices. I answered honestly in all cases.
And so you thought that was a legit poll?
I did. The first one, it was strange. I think the questions were tailored based on my previous answers. And, you know, there was a delay while they thought of the next question or picked it out of a linked list, and it felt ersatz. I can't really put my finger on it. But since then, the robocall started. I have my suspicions.
All right, Scott Keeter, are there decision trees in some of these surveys that if they answer this, then you go this way?
Yes. I mean, and certainly there are questions tailored to different kinds of people. McCain supporters might get one kind of question, and Obama supporters might get a different kind of question.
Yeah, that was what I felt. And, you know, they asked how I felt about Palin, and I said I'd sooner poke myself in the eye with a dull salted pencil than vote for a ticket with her on it.
Well, if you get salted pencils in the mail, you may have found yourself on a funny old list there.
There you go. All right, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call, Russell. And just for the listeners' information, I think the last Pew survey came out today showed Senator Obama with a 6-point lead.
Yes, that's right.
So we'll see how that comes out tomorrow night. Scott Keeter, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Scott Keeter is the Director of Survey Research at the Pew Research Center for People and the Press, joined us here in Studio 3A. Coming up, a special presidential edition of our movie festival, from Raymond Massey's Honest Abe to Anthony Hopkins' Tricky Dick.
My friends call me Mr. President.
And the rest of our fictional commanders-in-chief that defended this country. Murray Horowitz has them all. Who is your favorite? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, or drop us an email. That's talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And tomorrow, after bruising primary battles, breathless stump speeches, accusations and counter-accusations, we will vote in a new commander-in-chief, and, well, it's all worth it, right?
This is a price you pay to lead. You don't think that Abraham Lincoln was a whore before he was a president? He had to tell his little stories and smile his backcountry grin. And he did it just so that he would one day have the opportunity to stand in front of the nation and appeal to the better angels of our nature.
John Travolta playing a fictional, though somewhat recognizable, Governor Jack Stanton running for president in primary colors. Our fearless leaders on film battle more than madly slung mud. They face aliens, natural disasters, nuclear attacks, and, of course, Oliver Stone behind the camera. As we prepare to welcome a new leader of the executive branch, we look back at the heroes and anti-heroes who led the country on the silver screen and welcome back our movie buff-in-chief, Murray Horowitz. He's with us here in Studio 3 as usual. Hi, Murray.
Hi, good to see you, Neil.
So who is your favorite film president? Is it the muscular action hero, the romantic leading man, or those more, say, morally challenged? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And Murray, real and fictional presidents on film since A Birth of a Nation, going back a long way.
No, that is good. And morally challenged, that's a phrase I'm still getting my mind around. I'm going to use it a lot now.
Yeah, I think
speaking of which, you know, you do start with maybe in many ways the most important film portrayal of a president might be in one of the most important films of all time, D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation in 1915. And it was a very controversial, terrible, baboon-like presentation of Abraham Lincoln, and it was, I was about to say the 16th president. Was he the 16th president?
16th president.
And he was played by, who remembers, he was played by a man named Joseph Hannaberry, who had like a dozen roles in Birth of a Nation, but he was made up as Abraham Lincoln. And it was the first testimony of the fact that the way we portray ourselves and our leaders on screen is extremely influential.
Yet we see a lot of, for the first, 75 years of American cinema, you don't see a lot of shots of presidents as presidents. You see young Abe Lincoln. General Jackson. You don't see President. You did see President Jackson. But yeah. Anyway.
Both cases played by Charlton Heston, in fact, Andrew Jackson.
And FDR at sunrise at Campobello, right, where he's struggling with polio, not so much when he's,
There's a film that I know is a favorite of yours because it's a favorite of mine, where you see FDR from the back. And that's in a very, very wonderful musical, a biography of George M. Cohan called The Yankee Doodle Dandy, where he's played by a guy named, I've got it here, Jack Young is cast as the back of FDR.
I'm sorry I missed the opening of your show.
Maybe just as well.
Don't worry about it. We understand each other perfectly.
I think so.
The Herald Tribune says that you make a better president, and I'd rather be right than I am.
Don't forget, that's a Republican newspaper.
And my father thanks you, my mother thanks you. Anyway.
It's true. But you're right, and it tends to be, Neil, there are a lot of films about real presidents, or a fair number of films about real presidents, Lincoln and Wilson and this one and then Nixon. But when it comes to fictitious presidents, it tends not to be a great role I mean, it's a great role for an actor to do, but it tends to be two-dimensional. I mean, the jokes write themselves. Guess what? Why could it be that presidents are portrayed as being wooden and staid? Well, you can answer that yourself.
You know? Yeah, there you go.
But it's true. It tends to be a plot device. You know, let's take a big disaster movie or a big alien movie or something. You know, you bring in the leader of the free world and it becomes
an
effective plot.
Look at it this way. I'm not voting for Jack Nicholson, but I would vote for Morgan Freeman.
Yeah, right. You'd vote for Morgan Freeman. I might vote for Jack Nicholson. He's one of my favorite movie presidents.
Let's get Jill on the line, and Jill is calling us from Tallahassee in Florida.
I like Kevin Kline in Dave.
Right, you're not alone. Now, it's important to remember that in Dave, he's not really the president, right? He's playing a person
at the beginning before he falls over with a
right, exactly.
aneurysm or whatever.
And then he's Dave, a person playing a president. Right.
And yet he does an exceptional job.
Right.
And my favorite part is when he brings in his own accountant, Charles Grodin.
Yes.
And they so efficiently and without any fanfare balance the budget.
That's why they call it fiction.
Well, I still like it. And I think if they could do it, we should be able to do it as nonfiction.
I hope you're right, Jill. Thanks very much for the call.
Thanks, Jill.
And let's get Troy on the line. Troy Witherson of Louisville in Tennessee.
How are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
My favorite president in a movie is Michael Douglas in the movie entitled American President.
And it's weird. We got that call about Dave. This is almost the same cast, except for the President of the United States.
Right, right. And I think where we're going with this, if you look at the last few decades, you have these political figures who render themselves as everyday people. Bush did that in the last two elections, obviously why he won. Then you've got Barack Obama, who has his lowly beginnings and how he rose to the top. And then, of course, you got...
Born in a log cabin he built himself.
Right, yes. Right.
Right. So the American people seem to be fascinated with a leader who is kind of resembles us in a way, and then who can surround themselves with more intelligent advisors like Martin Sheen.
Right, exactly. Well, here
that, right?
In the American President, it's Michael Douglas as Andrew Shepard. And, the advice he's looking for is that from, his first date, Annette Bening.
Do you go out on that? Do you often...
Do I date a lot?
Yeah.
No, how about you?
Me? Well, lately I seem to be going out on a lot of first dates.
Well, then you're experienced at this.
Oh, yeah, you can ask me anything.
Well, how are we doing so far?
It's hard to say at this point. So far, it's just your typical first date stuff.
Damn, and I want to be different from the other guys.
You mentioned Martin Sheen, and there's a ground rule here. Don't forget, whenever we have these discussions in our Talk of the Nation Film Festival, the attenuated film festival, we don't count TV. And in this case, this is a real handicap because we're missing Martin Sheen, we're missing Paul Giamatti as John Adams, we're missing Gina Davis, and some of the real great actors and big stars who've done it on television, like Jason Robards, Gregory Peck, Walter Huston. There are a lot of TV presidents.
Troy, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Here was, by the way, another one for American President Michael Douglas. Mike in Charlotte, North Carolina, said his speech to the press corps at the end of the movie is one of the most eloquent summations of liberal policies. I am a proud liberal that I have ever met. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And let's go to Rob. Rob with us from Key West in Florida.
Hi, Neil. How's it going today?
Very well, thank you.
One I saw a couple of years ago was Man of the Year with Robin Williams. It really stuck to me because I talked to a lot of friends. I'm a registered independent myself. And whenever we hear any politician talking, we just want them to cut through the bull and just talk like a real human being. And in that movie, even with the outlandish breaking out into debates and breaking all the rules of conduct and everything, just really seemed to cut through all the mess and everything and just not say what the voters wanted to hear, but really able to voice an opinion. I thought having that take and Obama being compared to a celebrity earlier on in this campaign, when in this movie you actually had a celebrity that was in running for the presidency, it just seemed like, portrayed anyway, the American voters really were able to identify with a celebrity who wasn't scared about the political, you know, whiplash or anything of speaking his mind and stuff like that, and was just incredibly impressed by the way the direction that movie was taken from a director's standpoint.
Rob, thanks very much. This is a movie, one of those where it's really a lot of comedy until he actually gets into the office.
Right, and he gets in, and this is President Tom Dobbs, and he's one of a number of, like, sort of down with it, you know, people we would like to see as president of the United States. My favorite is In The Contender with Joan Allen, there's Jeff Bridges, who plays President Jackson Evans, and he's like this guy, say, hey, you want a tuna sandwich? Really, anything you want. You know, you can get it. It's great to be president. And it's like all of us would like to feel if we were president. I will say that with those names, you know, like, you know, President Jackson Evans or Tom Dobbs, we really haven't been very imaginative when it comes to presidents. There haven't
diversity,
been a lot,
not a big
diversity
issue.
Diversity's not a giant. Only one female African-American portrayal of a president that I could find, and that was the wonderful Lynn Thigpen, whom a lot of our listeners will remember as for her being the key person in a TV series called Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego. And she was in a movie in 1999 called Bicentennial Man, and she was President Marjorie Botha.
Well, let's get Mimi on the line. Mimi with us from Kansas City in Missouri.
Hi, yes. My favorite is Harrison Ford in Air Force One.
We played a clip of him earlier. Get off my plane.
Right.
Yeah. He's just so strong, and he's like, you just know he's going to take care of things, and he's selfless. And so I loved him. I just thought he's great.
Well, while he's in a headlock aboard Air Force One, in fact, one of the very few female presidents is sworn in. This is Glenn Close, who is sworn in as acting president while things are ensuing aboard Air Force
they
One.
They do ensue.
I'm going to go out there, and I'm going to take the oath of office. I'm going to run this government. And if some Islamic nations can't tolerate a female president, then I promise you, it will be more their problem than mine.
I thought she was going to say, I'm going to go out there a chorus girl, but I'm going to come back a star.
Out of secretary. Yeah, and you know what? There are a lot of people who agree with you, Mimi. In fact, there was an online poll. People were asked to vote this year for if there any of these characters were running for president, whom would they elect? And Harrison Ford as President James Marshall in Air Force One came in first place.
Again, I'm going for Morgan Freeman.
Morgan Freeman. Well, you know, we talk about lack of diversity, but one of the first movie presidents who really impressed me was James Earl Jones, who played the first African-American president in Rod Serling's last screenplay, and it's called The Man. It's from 1972.
And we have a clip of that here. Let's see if I can find my piece of paper here. This is James Earl Jones. Here, the president's daughter is furious with her newly appointed presidential father as he sets to turn over a black revolutionary to the apartheid government of South Africa.
Where on earth did I ever get the idea that you were honorable? You really must have conned me with your soft voice and your metaphors. Not honorable, scared. A privileged black man paying off and not having to live in the ghetto.
The house, nigga, right?
Right on. How the hell do you get out of the first family anyway? Do you just resign or what?
You just pick an exit and walk, if that's what you want.
We're talking about American Presidents on Film with Murray Horowitz of the AFI Silver Theater in Silver Spring, Maryland, here in the Washington, D.C. area. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get, is this Linus?
Yes.
Go ahead, Linus, from Marfa, Texas.
Well, I just like Frederick March in 7 Days in May because he was principled and real and had emotions and a range of emotions and stood for such progressive ideas.
Frederick March played the President of the United States, and here he is having it out with General James Mattoon Scott, played by Burt Lancaster.
You accuse me of having lost their faith, deliberately and criminally shut my ears to the national voice.
I do.
Well, where the hell have you heard that voice, General? In freight elevators? In dark alleys? In secret places in the dead of night? How did that voice seep into a locked room full of conspirators? That's not where you hear the voice of the people, General, not in this republic. You want to defend the United States of America, then defend it with the tools it supplies you with, its Constitution.
That's great stuff.
It is great stuff. It's one of Frederick March's last great roles, and it's not quite so famous as when he played the most famous non-president, William Jennings Bryan, actually is Matthew Harrison Brady in Inherit the Wind.
Wind, yes, absolutely, yeah. Thanks very much for the call, Linus.
You're welcome.
And there's another category. This is hands down emails, Gregory. Gregory James, I'm sure. Gregory J. Murphy, anyway, that's his whole name. He says, hands down, Peter Sellers as President Mervyn Merkin in Dr. Strangelove, and his most notable scene, the president scolded General Buck Turgeson, George C. Scott, and the Russian ambassador for fighting in the war room. We're not going to have any fighting in the war room. Of course, he also gets on the hotline to talk with his Russian counterpart.
Of course I like to speak to you. Of course I like to say hello. Not now, but any time, Dmitri. I'm just calling up to tell you something terrible has happened. It's a friendly call. Of course it's a friendly call. Listen, if it wasn't friendly, you probably wouldn't have even got it.
It really is. I'm very grateful to Gregory because this is, you can't talk about presidents on film without talking about Merkin Muffley and Peter Sellers' role, one of his, three or four
roles yeah.
In Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. It really is one of the greatest, one of the underrated performances that I kind of couple with it is somebody we don't think of as a movie star, but Bob Newhart played President Manfred Link in First Family, a 1980 film in which he was similarly believably hapless. It was just, there's a truth about the presidency and the president that those guys tapped into.
And we've talked about this before, but Dr. Strangelove is virtually the same picture. One's a comedy, a satire. The other one, dead serious, as Failsafe, where Henry Fonda is the president of the United States on the phone with his Russian counterpart.
All I know is that men are responsible. We're responsible for what happens to us. Today we had a taste of the future. Do we learn from it or do we go on the way we have? What do we do, Mr. Chairman? What do we say to the dead?
Of course, it's hard to have a comedy after you've blown up Moscow and New York.
But both of those pictures you're absolutely right. They're kind of, I don't know about mirror images, but they're two sides of the same coin. And they were both made in 1964.
Both made in the same, it's insane. Let's see if we can play one more clip here. And this is Lee Tracy, who was nominated for an Oscar for his portrayal as the president in The Best Man.
I am here to tell you this. That power is not a toy that we give to good children. It's a weapon. And the strong man takes it and he uses it. And if you don't go down there and beat Joe Cantwell to the floor with this very dirty stick, then you've got no business in this big league. Because if you don't fight, this job is not for you.
Well, Murray, this job is for you. Who's the best American president on film?
Oh, well, I mean, there are a lot of people that I'm, as you can imagine, there are a lot of the comedy presidents that I like. But, you know, in this case, Neil, why mess around when you can have the real thing? I have to say, in the 1951 movie, Ronald Reagan in Bedtime for Bonzo.
Oh, come on.
I couldn't resist.
I'm tempted to go for Dan Hedaya in
Dan
Dick.
Hedaya was a great Nixon.
I thought he was better than Anthony Hopkins.
He might have been better than Richard Nixon.
Could have been.
No, but I would have to say that I got to go for Peter Sellers. I really think that is one of the great characterizations of a major public official ever put on film.
Murray Horowitz, as always, thanks for spending Eve with us. Murray Horowitz.
Don't forget to vote early and vote often.
Director and COO of the American Film Institute Silver Theater and Cultural Center here in the Washington, D.C. area. Tomorrow, it's Election Day. We'll talk about what's happening where you are, and we'll hope you join us then. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.